We've reconvened the Court of Appeals. The date is November 6, 2019. We have two matters on via ITV. The first is State of Minnesota versus Eric Bronging, coming from Beltrami County. We ask each attorney to identify themselves when they begin the presentation. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument, and the appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, if you're prepared to begin, please do so.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Eric Bronning. Mr. Bronning was convicted of felon in possession of a firearm based upon a predicate felony of a 2012 fifth-degree controlled substance conviction. Mr. Bronning challenges his conviction on grounds that the prior conviction, which would be a gross misdemeanor if committed today, is not a valid predicate felony for two reasons. First, to determine the present-day impact of a prior conviction, you look to the current offense definition, not the disposition. And second, the state's interpretation of the law violates equal protection because similarly situated individuals may exercise their constitutional right to bear arms.
Counsel, isn't the problem that it didn't happen today and that, in fact, you're asking us to make this law retroactive?
To do is look at Mr. Bronning's conduct on July 9th, 2018, and determine that he is was possessing a firearm on that day and that he is not similarly situated to individuals who were not possessing a firearm or who do not have a prior conviction.
So, counsel, the way you just stated that makes me think your focus is on your equal protection argument. Is that right? Or is you seem to, I mean, the way I read your brief, you're asserting both a statutory interpretation argument as well as an equal protection argument. Obviously, that also deals with statutory interpretation, but, you know, that you have two separate prongs. Is that right? Or do I misunderstand?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Bronning's conviction is improper for two reasons. One, based upon statutory interpretation, and this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Moon and Anderson and Foster, and then second, that it would violate equal protection.
Did you raise the equal protection argument with the district court with Judge Schluter in this case?
The issue was not specifically raised as an equal protection argument. Mr. Bronning argued below that the offense was not a valid predicate felony.
But, I read through the briefing pretty carefully as well as the transcripts, and I didn't see any reference to a constitutional challenge, either under federal provision for equal protection or under the state constitutional analysis. So did I miss something?
You did not miss anything, okay. Your Honor. That's correct. The issue was not specifically raised as an equal protection violation.
Okay. And so obviously, we do have some generally, we don't review issues for the first time, but sometimes we do. So are you going to give us a rationale for why we should look at the equal protection issue when it wasn't raised below?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a very well-established exception to the general rule that you will not review issues that were not raised below. And that is if it is plainly decisive the entire controversy on the merits, and then also if there's no possible disadvantage to either party in not having a prior ruling below. And that is from Watson versus United Auto Services, a 1997 case out of the Minnesota Supreme Court. That case and many other cases from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have determined that factors weighing in favor of review include the following. First, if it's a novel issue of first impression. Second, if the issue was prominently raised in a briefing. Third, if the issue was implicit or closely akin to the arguments made below. And fourth, if the issue is not dependent on any new or uncontroverted facts. And in this case, it meets all of those factors. The issue is dispositive. There's no possible disadvantage. This is a de novo review based on...
Well, there is a disadvantage if you're raising an as-applied challenge, because as far as I can tell, you didn't serve the Attorney General with notice of this claim.
Correct.
or did you?
Your Honor, the state is a party to this case, so Rule 144 doesn't apply.
When you say the state, are you talking about the county? But you did not serve the Attorney General's office, though, with notice of a constitutional challenge.
Your Honor, Rule 144 applies when the state is not a party. So when the state is a party, we are not required to serve the Attorney General's office. But I would note that Keith Ellison is a party to this appeal.
Mm-hmm. And let me go at it from a different angle. I mean, given we do have this, and you're conceding it, that the issue, equal protection issue, was not raised below. So are you making an as-applied challenge or a facial challenge? It sounds to me like an as-applied. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
This is an as-applied, not a facial challenge. So we're not challenging the constitutionality of the felon in possession statute. The argument is that the statute as applied to Mr. Bronning violates equal protection because he is similarly situated to individuals who are able to exercise the constitutional right to bear arms.
Yeah, and at least our court has said that in an as-applied challenge, no notice to the Attorney General is required. I don't think the Minnesota Supreme Court has made that quite as clear, but they have stated that. So, but let me ask you a different question, counsel. So, your underlying premise to your argument is that if Mr. Bronning had committed his offense today, that it would, under the DSRA, then would apply to him, right? And when I say this offense, I'm talking about his 2012 conviction. So if it were committed today, that the DSRA would apply to him, right? Okay, so I'm unclear on that on your record because the DSRA definitely changed the classification for fifth degree possession of controlled substances, but it did it depending on the weight, right? And we don't know the weight involved for Mr. Bronning's prior conviction. At least I didn't see it in the record, but maybe I'm wrong. Well, that's not how they put it in their brief. I don't know. Would you like to respond to that? I mean, their interpretation of that discussion at sentencing, I think, is consistent with the Minnesota Supreme Court cases, which say that when it comes to determining criminal history score, and looking back at these older convictions, the state has the burden to prove, in light of statutory changes, how that criminal history score should be calculated. The state just waived the issue in Mr. Bronning's case for this particular issue. They didn't object. That's different from saying we know what the weight was, and we know that under the DSRA, Mr. Bronning's 2012 conviction would be deemed a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor. I mean, it is different.
I understand that, Your Honor. Explained that after reading the complaint or reading the information provided as part of the stipulated facts trial, that it was clear that it would have been a gross misdemeanor today, and the state did not object to that. So that was my reading of the transcript. I understand that the state appears to be making a different argument on appeal, but that was not part of the transcript.
So you think if I go back to the sentencing hearing, I'm just going to find that weight isn't an issue?
I believe that's what you'll find.
And that's what you rely on. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I would note that if the state really does believe that there is some issue of fact, then perhaps the appropriate remedy here would be to remand. And if it was a trace amount, then the felon in possession sentence or conviction could be vacated, and if not, then it would stand. But my reading of that transcript is that there is no real dispute about the prior conviction being for a small amount of money.
All right, let me ask you about your legal assumptions on the first issue. So the first argument you raise, which as we talked about earlier, is really how is the terminology prior conviction going to be viewed for a felon in possession conviction? So you say it should be viewed the same way we're viewing convictions for criminal history scores, right? Using current offense definitions, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, but the argument is really based upon this court, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Moon and Anderson and Foster, not just based on Strobel. In Moon, Anderson, and Foster, which all are cited in our brief, the defendants were convicted of felonies, but those convictions were deemed a misdemeanor upon completion of probation. Those cases made clear that the legislature intended for the nature of the offense rather than the subsequent treatment of the offender to be the basis for the imposition of the firearms restriction. It just so happened in all of those cases, the defendants had misdemeanors on their record, but the underlying conduct was still felonious. In this case, we really have the opposite situation where there is a felony on his record, but the underlying conduct is no longer a felony. So it's the same principle. It's just a reverse in circumstances.
So I guess I maybe misassessed your argument. You're not relying so strongly on an analogy to the Supreme Court's treatment of criminal history scores as you are to their, like you just articulated, their underlying focus in Moon and Anderson on looking at the elements of the offense. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes,
but
that's correct.
I guess what I'm still struggling with is how do we go from the statutory definition of what the elements are of a felon in possession to then looking at the prior offense under current statutory definitions. In the criminal history cases, they had a really clear link because they looked at the sentencing guidelines, right? And the Supreme Court interpreted the sentencing guidelines to mean that for criminal history scores, we would look at the current statutory definitions. But I just don't see that in the felon in possession statute. So maybe I'm being too literal and you can guide me otherwise.
I think that the close reading of Moon supports our position. In Moon, the Supreme Court said that it's clear that the legislature intended the nature of the offense rather than the subsequent treatment of the offender to be the basis. The court further talked about how 609.165 is designed to protect public safety by keeping firearms out of the hands of offenders who have committed crimes that the legislature believes indicative of future dangerousness. The court in Moon said the statute does not impose consequences of a felony, but rather consequences based upon an offender's commission of certain criminal acts. So what that really says is what you do is you look to the elements of the offense as they are currently defined. In Moon, for example, they looked to the elements of the offense as currently defined, and it was still a felony. Therefore, he could not possess a firearm. In this case, the legislature has made a determination that possession of a small amount of a controlled substance is no longer indicative of a future dangerousness. So there is no basis to have a lifetime firearms ban.
Can you go back and you talked about the Moon case. I understood in the Moon case that the conviction reverted to a misdemeanor after the probationary conditions were fulfilled. Is that your understanding of the holding in Moon? Would that not be very different than in this case where the felony is still a felony?
The point in Moon is that you don't look to whether it is on the defendant's record as a felony or a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor. You look to the underlying conduct in the case. And if you look to the underlying conduct in Moon, his prior conviction, the conduct that he committed was still considered a felony and therefore would still be indicative of future dangerousness, at least according to the legislature's belief. In the case involving the cases involving the drug resentencing reform or the Drug Sentencing Reform Act, the legislature has determined that possession of a small amount of a controlled substance is not indicative of future dangerousness. And we know this because the legislature knew this was going to happen, knew that future offenders would not be subject to a lifetime ban. But they did not amend Section 6109165 to include gross misdemeanor violations of Section 152, or Chapter 152. So what those cases really stand for is that the impact of the prior conviction on present-day conduct is based upon the elements of the offense and not the disposition. It's simply the opposite of what happened in Moon and Anderson and Foster. And for all of these reasons, Mr. Bronig's 2012 conviction is not a valid predicate crime of violence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Malin. I'm representing the state of Minnesota. Minnesota statute 609165 subdivision 1B parent A provides that any person who has been convicted of a crime of violence as defined in section 624712 subdivision 5 if ships, transports, possesses, or receives a firearm commits a felony. Minnesota statute 624712 subdivision 5 defines crime of violence to include felony convictions of chapter 152. In 2012, appellant was convicted of a felony fifth degree possession of controlled substance. To this day, appellant remains convicted of that crime of violence. The state urges a plain reading of the statute, finding that appellant is correctly convicted of possessing a firearm in violation of Minnesota Statute 609165 subdivision 1B parent A. Appellant's conviction for felony possession should be affirmed because he is convicted of a felony crime of violence. Neither the passing of the DSRA will affect that, and that is made clear in State v. Otto and State v. Kirby. Furthermore, in his reply brief, appellant indicates that he's not disputing the validity of his fifth-degree possession conviction, and for all practical purpose, agrees that appellant has a felony on his record. The state argues that State v. Moon is distinguishable from appellant's case because that case involves a stay of imposition on a theft case. The court had to look at the elements of the underlying felony because the conviction had changed from a felony to a misdemeanor. In our case, the court need not look at the elements of the 2012 conviction because that conviction remains a felony crime of violence.
Counsel, do you agree that the state at sentencing agreed that there was a trace amount of marijuana involved here?
The state does not agree with that.
Okay, that's not going to appear anywhere in the record?
No. I believe what will be reflected in the record is a state's lack of objection to giving Mr. Bronig a criminal history point commensurate with a gross misdemeanor, simply because the state recognizes under Strobel that it is the state's burden to prove a criminal history score. And continuing on, the state would argue that appellant's reference to Scoville is misplaced because Scoville regards criminal history score calculations, not it has not been extended to a new offense.
So, counsel, if you would address the equal protection argument, I'd appreciate that. I mean, in particular, I'm curious about you didn't object to this court reaching the merits of the equal protection in your brief. So, does that mean you think we should go ahead and address it?
Your Honor, the state recognizes that typically, if something an issue is not raised at the lower court level, defense may be forfeited from bringing that issue up. The state would have no objection and is prepared to address the equal protection argument. The state would argue that appellant's classifications are incorrect. Appellant argues that the two relevant classes would be those who can possess firearms and those who cannot. The state disagrees with that, would argue that a more accurate assessment of the classifications would be those convicted of violating Chapter 152 prior to the passage of the DSRA and those convicted of violating Chapter 152 after the passage of the DSRA. As appellant is a member of the former group, He cannot successfully raise an equal protection claim by arguing he is similarly situated with members of the latter group. Appellant cannot show that he is treated differently from anyone convicted of violating Chapter 152 prior to the passage of the DSRA. And therefore, appellant has not met his heavy burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he's being treated differently than similarly situated persons. Ultimately, knowing that the Minnesota Court of Appeals is an error-correcting court, from the state's perspective, there has been no error, and appellant's conviction should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just briefly, related to the sentencing issue, this court looks to page 4 in the sentencing transcript. The state said he had no grounds to object to the prior conviction being used as being considered a gross misdemeanor.
So, counsel, I did take a quick look at the sentencing transcript, and I just don't see a reference by either lawyer to the amount. So, you know, there is no record on what the amount was, so it's not very clear that if Mr. Browning had been convicted of the, the 2012 offense had occurred under the DSRA, that he would have, his conviction would have been reduced. I mean, I just see, you're right, there's a discussion about how should that criminal history score be calculated, but in light of the Supreme Court's decisions, to me, that sounds like a different issue. It's not the same.
Your Honor, I think that the appropriate remedy would be to reverse with instructions to look at that issue about whether the prior conviction was a meritorious amount. My reading of the record is that there was no real dispute about that below, but if there is a dispute, then remand with instructions would be appropriate. I do want to address a couple other issues that the state brought up. First, the state said that the defense has a heavy burden to prove that classes are similarly situated. That is a misquote in Johnson. Johnson actually says the defendant bears a heavy burden of proving a statute is unconstitutional, and that applies in cases where there's a facial challenge to the statute. So there is simply not a heavy burden to prove that the classes are similarly situated.
So what is your argument about that the felon in possession statute has created two classifications, right? And so in what way do you articulate that as those classes are similarly situated? Because it seems to me we are, in light of Kirby and Otto, we are dealing with a group of offenders that the legislature has decided, some of whom are going to walk out depending on whether their case was still pending when the DSRA was passed, with a felony conviction for the rest of their lives, and some of whom will walk out with a different, a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor. So,
yes, Your Honor. So in this case, two people possess firearms. Both have prior convictions for possessing a small amount of methamphetamine, one prior to 2016 and one after. These two people are similarly situated, but for the date of their prior conviction. One person is committing a felony and subject to a 60-month sentence based upon the conduct of possessing a firearm. So Mr. Browning is a member of a class of people who is not permitted to exercise his constitutional right to bear arms. Holloway is really the best example of how to establish the two classes. In Holloway, the court considered whether it violated equal protection to permit a mistake of age defense in criminal sexual conduct cases if the defendant was less than 120 months older than the victim, but not for defendants more than 120 months older than the victim. The state's interpretation of what the classes are in this case, it would be as if in Holloway, it would define the class of all people more than 120 months older than their victims versus people who are less than 120 months older than their victim. That is simply too narrow of a class. The question is, on the day the conduct occurred, is he similar to a class committing the same conduct in every respect except for the date of the prior conviction? And Mr. Bronig classes are similarly situated, except for the date of the prior offense. Mr. Bonney, respectfully ask this court to reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Mr. Whelan, thank you both. The matter will be taken under advisement, and an opinion will issue in 90 days.